look, because you a bugaboo.
No, you're the bugaboo.
You're the bugaboo. Hello, and welcome to Expected Own Goals. I am your host, Eric Morgan.
I'm Evan Davis.
And this week, we are talking about two teams that absolutely needed a win and got them, and what those wins represent, and maybe what they don't represent. But before that, let's just move around the league. Some people on heaters continued to have heaters. Barbara Banda plays 45 minutes, scores two goals.
I was nervous that she got pulled because she looked like she was hobbling a little bit right at the halftime whistle, but then she was jumping around celebrating at the end of the game, so I think it's fine.
It also just speaks to how effective 45 minutes of Barbara Banda is. You can just win a game with 45 minutes of Barbara Banda.
There's a moment, the first game that she started, which is now over a month ago, which is hard to believe, where Gary Bailey on the broadcast said, he spoke as though everybody just knew what Barbara Banda was all about. And we know something about what Barbara Banda is all about. We've seen her play in World Cups and Olympics, but we've never seen her play for a club team in a, you know, highly competitive environment. And I remember thinking, like, how can you be so confident in your answer? And now I clearly have to take the own goal on that.
I don't know, like, there's a difference between, like, being wrong and showing caution.
Sure. Healthy skepticism.
Yeah, some healthy skepticism. And healthy skepticism, I think, is a big deal when analyzing this sport.
But it is just funny how retroactively it almost feels as if Gary Bailey was underrating her after a game and a half.
Obviously, I suspect Barbara Banda will slow down, but...
We keep saying that, and yet...
But that's just because I believe that what she's doing is incredible, but basically not sustainable.
Well, no, because very few people can sustain this level of performance.
What is her XG right now versus...
I think it's about 0.7 per 90.
I do expect her to end the season right around there.
Yeah, which is would be one of the best chance-creating seasons in NWSL history. Like up there with Sam Kerr in her prime with Chicago and stuff.
Yeah, and Orlando, who looked a lot worse against Portland in that second half.
That second half is the worst defensive half they've had all year.
Our priors about both teams probably hold.
Mm-hmm.
Orlando is very good. Portland is also quite good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think your article midweek for Backheeled about sort of Portland and its defensive resolutions probably was not well-timed coming out in advance of playing Barbara Banda.
Sure. Yeah.
But I think actually the conclusions you came to are basically correct.
I'm actually more interested in Portland's attack from the weekend because they didn't have Sophia Smith. And based on that first half, it really felt like they needed her. And then in the second half, they managed to cobble it together.
I'm like quietly charting the emergence of Peyton Linehan as a very real threat and like a very potent addition to this team. She's obviously not having one of the most pronounced breakout seasons for rookies in this league. We're actually going to cover a couple people who are, but she is quietly finding really nice places in that Thornton's offense and looks like, especially with Weaver out for a while, like they might have a solid replacement.
You know, she kind of had a quiet game against Orlando, but if she can sustain something like consistent production, that also means you don't have to feel obligated to play Olivia Moultrie on the wing, where she's not as effective and as she is playing underneath the forward line. That would be to the Thorns' huge advantage. Izzy Diakila's goal was great.
Great passing sequence to set up that goal.
You know what wasn't great? the derby between Angel City and San Diego Wave, which I guess the highlight of that was the fact that both Becky Tweed and Casey Stoney got yellow cards, which is peak derby behavior.
I mean, we're going to need to touch on those two teams sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Angel City is still spinning downward.
San Diego looks less troubled than Angel City, but we're getting to the point in the season where they're going to need to start putting points on the board.
Yeah. And, you know, the main theme of both Casey Stoney and Savannah McCaskill in the post-match pressers, which I was in attendance for, just they kept hammering the notion that, like, they need to put the ball in the back of the net. And Stoney actually was annoyed that their best chances were all off target and went wide of the posts. I mean, you had some good looks at goal. I don't know if I'd beat yourself up too hard about running into some bad finishing luck, but you do you.
I think when you're going through what San Diego's going through, you look for all kinds of explanations.
Yeah.
That aren't just like the underlying stuff isn't working. And I'm not totally sure that the underlying stuff isn't working for San Diego, but it certainly isn't working the way it has worked for Casey Stoney.
In the past.
Yeah, in her prior seasons with San Diego.
She should feel fine. She just got Naomi Gurma, Abby Dahlkemper, and Alex Morgan back on the field. So, chill. Just hope they don't get hurt at international camp. But moving on.
We should talk about Mandy Haught on an absolute heater.
Yeah.
And like what Mandy Haught's doing this season, it's nuts.
Yeah, and I feel really bad for her. Mandy Haught is facing the toughest shots of any goalkeeper, and that's not surprising.
Nope.
Utah is Swiss cheese at the back, and they are giving strikers plenty of time to set their shots up to go toward the post or toward the corners. You know, if you average a bunch of different post shot XG models together, you get Mandy Haught's post shot XG per shot number is 0.44, which is, I believe, second place is like 0.35. And maybe you don't love numbers with decimal points like that, but that's a massive, massive gulf between her and the rest of the pack. Like, she is under siege constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And she's still basically a league average shot stopper relative to the shots that she's expected to save and the ones that she does save. It's more or less a 1-to-1 ratio. That's very, very impressive.
Yeah.
Because Kansas City put up almost 3 non-penalty XG against Utah over the weekend, and they scored 1 goal.
And that's the second week in a row Mandy Haught has allowed 1 goal against 3 XG.
Exactly.
It's, again, small sample, goalies go on heaters.
She's in the middle of a real heater, and Amy Rodriguez better be kissing the ground that she walks on. Speaking of which, you should all listen to our friend Theo Lloyd Hughes' podcast, Squad Depth. Just put up a great interview with Utah Royals sporting director Kelly Cousins, which I thought was quite candid, forthright, and very, very honest about the state of the team.
Mm-hmm.
And also where, you know, maybe if you read between the lines, where Kelly Cousins and Amy Rodriguez, they're not quite on the same page all the time. And maybe they don't have to be because they're, you know, responsibility is delegated in very different areas with their jobs. However, you know, it's interesting. I think A-Rod really wants to win right now, and Cousins wants to build for the future.
Listening to that interview, as Kelly Cousins framed it, it was like a pragmatist struggling to deal with an idealist.
Mm-hmm.
And that is often, when you have those two people sort of leading the direction of a football team, a really tough position to be in.
Because yeah, I mean, and you can see it bear out, right? Like, Utah, the reason that Utah is so open is that they want to play a high line and press from the front. And they're like, you know, they're league average on passes per defensive action. They are, and then you realize that, like, that doesn't matter because they're like toward the bottom of the list when looking at generating turnovers in the attacking third per game, which shows you that they want to press, they're just not really getting the results from said pressure. And, you know, you gotta be a little bit more pragmatic. And we've seen that in flashes from them, but when you're up against Tamwa Chiwenga, even pragmatism goes out the window.
No question. And Kansas City just keeps clicking along, too.
Just chugging right along.
Let's get to our two teams. One I think we've under-discussed, and the other I think we need to maybe start shifting our perception of.
Mm-hmm.
So who do you want to tackle first? Do you want to tackle Louisville or do you want to tackle Houston? Both teams who got massive, massive wins.
Let's start with Houston, who not only walloped the North Carolina Courage 3-0, but really deserved the victory. The XG split on that is 1.6 to 0.9. per ASA's model. This is easily Houston's best performance of the year.
Frankly, it looked like it almost from the jump.
Mm-hmm.
I had yet to see their press working as well to sort of generate shots.
Mm-hmm.
There was an early chance, I don't even think it counted or registered as a shot, that Bachman had. There was a byproduct of the high press sort of seizing control and in sub 4 passes creating a shot in the final third. In the 6th minute, and then it just sort of kept happening.
Yeah.
And again, this is against probably the best or at least the most persistent possession team in the league, who are quite comfortable playing out of the back, and Houston just finding a way to clog channels, to press deny outlets, to really use their shape to their full advantage.
The best chance of, or maybe one of the two best chances of the first half is a result of that pressure.
Yeah.
The Michel Olozier shot in like the 23rd minute that is entirely a result of just pouncing immediately on North Carolina trying to play out the back. Like, they win the ball back like right in front of the box.
Yeah.
Before Olozier's shot. And again, like you said, like, Houston's never been that organized.
No.
When attempting to apply attacking half pressure.
No, and I think if you're looking for a reason to sort of justify Fran Alonso keeping his job, it's that North Carolina absolutely decimated Houston earlier in the season. And this game felt like Alonso doing some pretty deep soul searching about how to beat North Carolina and applying all of the lessons from that defeat effectively to sort of turn North Carolina into sloppy pressured mush at the back.
You know how they're going to play. Everybody knows how North Carolina is going to play. So if you can use that to your advantage and stay compact so that they are not able to thread passes vertically, then you and just make sure that they can't play through your shape. You have to force them around your shape. Then you can slow them down. I mean, our friend Sebastian Bush, who runs at NWSL Stat on, I'm still going to call it Twitter, he is now putting out these really, honestly, kind of beautiful looking field control heat maps to show like what areas of the field each team is getting the majority of the touches. And, you know, the biggest and widest and brightest color is North Carolina, but it's all in their defensive half. And there are all of these areas of contested space on either side of the box where they felt like they had to funnel passes wide where, you know, the Amanda Wests of the world could try and put pressure. And then you look at Houston's passing network, like, they've got three players lined up behind Olozier, who's also playing through the middle, which I thought was kind of a smart choice. Which means you're taking away the center from North Carolina, which is where they like to eventually like move the ball into. Mm-hmm. So if that's your area of pressure, North Carolina just did not have answers. They had 64% of the ball and did fuck all with it all game.
Their heat map looks a little bit like a sideways turned Rothko, and I don't mean that in a positive way, where in their own half, the bulk of the color exists.
I think also just Houston in possession, like they did not play expansively, and maybe this is where we can move towards your point about Alonso learning some lessons, is, you know, he's returned to the back three structure, mm-hmm. which he had been moving toward a back four because he wanted to tighten things up, but he's back to a back three structure. But every single line, there is just not a lot of vertical space between it when they're playing mm-hmm. the ball. They're not, you know, trying to pump things out wide and really, really get stretched, which is where they get killed when they inevitably turn the ball over. Yesterday against North Carolina, it was a very, very compact, very tight shape that, again, using Olozier as sort of like the lone forward and pulling Amanda West and who was the...
Avery Patterson.
Yeah. You know, keeping both of those players high, but, you know, to some extent, fairly narrow so they can be available to, you know, pinch in defensively or try and work space within the central channel. Like, Malia Berkeley had kind of a shocker.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she is part of the reason that Olozier gets that shot off in the 23rd minute, and then she's entirely responsible for the ball ending up at Deanna Ordonez's feet that results in goal number three.
Yep.
Because they just seemed rattled. North Carolina just never seemed settled or comfortable, even with 64% of the ball.
It's one of those where, like, what you do with possession
mm-hmm.
matters so much. And North Carolina, again, sort of found itself in that possession for possession's sake without a lot of productivity. Whereas Houston really was taking opportunities on the press to create quick shots. They were doing like kind of gegenpressing in the right mm-hmm. in the right kinds of ways and finding opportunities to make turnovers into transitional chances, which, as we've talked about, are good chances. I actually want to take a minute and talk about one thing that we have been pretty complimentary of with Houston, and I think should probably continue being pretty complimentary about with Houston, and that is the work that we've seen Alex Singer as general manager doing all season. Because last year's Houston team, they had the least number of goals conceded as well as scored in the league, but that was kind of a mirage.
A Jane Campbell influenced mirage.
Exactly. But even Jane Campbell standing on her head, which she really did do last season, shouldn't have covered for what that defense actually was, which was not terrible, but not great. And considering what the offensive output was, the whole project felt underwhelming. And Singer, I think, has properly blown up what lots of other teams would not have attempted to blow up and would have called defensive solidity, and brought in a coach who blew that up, but has also made shrewd, I think, signings, certainly since the season began. The Paige Nielsen move is looking very good. And
yeah, she's feeling more settled now.
And Tarciane, at 20 years old, in her debut match, we made a little fun of Tarciane just being like a potential game changer for Houston and that solving Houston's problems, but like kind of did as much as one could hope for a 20-year-old center back in their debut. She looked fantastic.
Oh, yeah, and so much of their defensive issues have been having to play players out of position because they're so thin there, with Katie Lynn being on maternity leave, Natalie Jacobs having some injury issues. You know, all of a sudden, Sophie Schmidt and Courtney Peterson are playing back there. That's not where you want them. And Tarciane, they use the Maria Sanchez transfer money to go get her, and you can see why she would have cost $500,000 in transfer fees, because she is, you know, I remember before the season, I thought that maybe Lauren Costa was sort of the face of the Brazilian defense going forward based on what she did in the Gold Cup. But Costa can't get into the Kansas City lineup, and Tarciane was a bulldozer.
Absolutely. It felt like, and I talked about it in the past couple of weeks, quietly, Houston, since the drubbing against Gotham, has sort of looked like they're putting it together. That Angel City win is pivotal. They look good in stretches against the Thorns, who, while the XG in that game sort of suggests the result, it understates the result. You felt like you were seeing Houston actually putting it together against a really dangerous team. And then last night sort of felt like the culmination of what has been largely a frustrating season.
Oh, a disastrous season. Yeah.
Frustrating is an understatement. You're right. A potentially disastrous season. You felt like maybe a corner was turning. And so I guess my question to you is, do you feel like Houston is on the cusp of turning a corner? And because of the points that they've put on the board, despite their statistical inefficiency for a lot of the season, they're now just, you know, level on points with the last playoff spot, Louisville, who we'll get to.
Yeah.
Do you think this Houston team is capable of writing off the first part of their season and stepping forward as this team we saw last night for the rest of the season? Or do you think that's overstating it?
I think maybe that's overstating a little bit, just because we've only seen, I'm just looking at their, their game by game non-penalty XG differential. They've only got one game on the year where their differential is above one, and that was on Friday. They've only got three games where their differential was positive at all, and those were, you know, the two wins against Angel City and Bay FC on the road, which they barely scraped through.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only last week where the Thorns handed them their ass. So, you know, I mean, like, as you say, Tarciane is here now. Nielsen is feeling more comfortable. They can keep players sort of in natural positions. Again, they did look like, it did look like everybody was on the same page yesterday, which you could not have said about Houston at all at any point, really, throughout the season. So maybe that's the start of something new, but I'm going to need to see this repeat at least a few more times before I feel comfortable saying Houston is a playoff contender. I thought it was smart or I don't know if it was smart, but it was interesting to see Alozia through the middle.
Yeah.
She seemed quite comfortable there, even though she's traditionally a winger or a wingback. Should Diana Ordóñez only be a sub now? She scored the best chance and the best goal of the game, possibly the best goal of the season for Houston.
In terms of XG, I mean, it's a rebounded shot as well, but yeah.
But it also comes off of like a, what is it, like a 60-yard through ball?
Yeah, fair.
That is in part, you know, a mistake by Malia Berkeley, but also has to do with Ordóñez keeping Berkeley off balance and running off the shoulder in a really, really smart way. Yeah, I don't know. I just every time it seems like things are going well for Houston, the bottom drops out a week later. So let's see. Let's see. I mean, but it is significant that you can do that to the Courage, who are nominally a better team than you, and do it legitimately, deservedly, and convincingly.
And who absolutely beat the ever-loving crap out of you earlier this season.
Yeah, on opening day.
I look at the table below them right now. They're in 10th.
Mm-hmm.
Angel City, I don't think is trending in the right direction. Bay, I don't know. The Rain look really not good. And Utah, who just have different objectives. At this point, or should have different objectives. And I sort of say, maybe the Dash, if I were doing power rankings, would justify their position 10th in the table on the back of that performance. But if they regress against who we're about to talk about next in their upcoming fixture, I think that we'll learn a lot from their game against Louisville in early June.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, looking at the teams just ahead of them, Louisville and San Diego, I have a difficult time thinking that Louisville or San Diego are going to backslide enough to let Houston back into it.
Fair. But again, this was a really positive step forward from the Dash.
And I'll say, if they finish 10th this year with like a respectable goal difference, you have to say it's a successful season based on how the first, you know, 8 or 9 games of the year went.
Totally. And sometimes the process really is the process.
Mm-hmm.
I think after 9-10 games, you need to start seeing results like the one that happened against the Courage in Houston on Friday. If you start seeing those strung together, it justifies the chaos that came before it, or what appeared to be chaos, and instead was experimentation.
Yeah, again, it's just like you peel back the layers, 0.18 non-penalty XG per shot when league average is 0.1. That's outstanding. 24 touches in the box, league average is 23 per game. Houston hasn't really been able to do that with any kind of consistency. Not, I think, what, like 2, maybe 3 of their shots were further away than 15 yards.
Mm-hmm.
That's all good. That's all very, very strong underlying data to pin improvement on. So, yeah, we'll see if they can just start doing it week to week.
So let's talk about their upcoming opponent after the international break.
Mm.
Let's talk about Louisville, a team you were very high on last year.
I was very high on their players. I was not high on them as a team.
And yeah, sure.
That is an important distinction.
But now I think there's reason to be. I've been high on them. I picked them to make the playoffs before the season. I've been cautiously optimistic about them. And now I think there's just reason to be optimistic.
Mm.
And there kind of has been. But 10 games, 6 draws.
Yeah.
That is an incredible amount of futility in terms of like taking advantage of your performances. Mm. But against Chicago, a team who I know we both have question marks about, but who we think have probably put enough points on the board to at least, you know, be in with a shout, they looked decisively like the better team.
Yeah, until maybe the last, I don't know, 15 minutes or so when Chicago, just due to game state, sort of worked their way back into it.
To be fair, Louisville has blown a lot of leads this season, so
yeah,
even that didn't happen. Huge.
Emma Sears, outside the box screamer. Don't know if you're going to replicate that in the future, but it looked awesome.
It was just inside the box.
Okay.
It was just as ridiculous.
Yeah, because that's also the angle at which she takes it. But no, I mean, like, they played a very aggressive game against an opponent that probably didn't warrant any caution, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever elements of Chicago that are going well and seem to be consistently going well, namely Sam Staub and Mallory Swanson. But what that means is if you just hold on to the ball and exert some pressure on Staub, if they win it back in their own half, then you're going to keep them quiet. And that's basically what happened for the majority of the game, barring two, maybe three chances. I mean, Carson Pickett and Laura Millay, you know, they were just averaging all of their touches in the attacking half. They did not spend much time in Louisville's own half.
And frankly, other than the very tail end of the first half, it was pretty one-way traffic for Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
I thought their press, I thought their interplay and passing combinations, I thought their movement, all excellent in the first half. And the Sears goal is what they deserved, even if it was sort of a freak occurrence goal.
Yeah.
It's a marvelous shot. I think it will end up on the goal of the season list. It reminded me a little bit of a Fernando Torres goal from like 2007, 2008. It just was a player who was full of confidence, poised, and decided to fire an absolute missile from a tight angle with a pure strike because they saw that opening and knew they could do it. And I sort of feel like it was a stand-in for kind of what the entirety of Louisville's offense felt like, at least in that first half. They were a team playing like they knew they were better and exerting that for the first 45 minutes. Mm. And frankly, did it all the way until, about the 80th minute mark when they decided to just preserve their lead.
It's not just that they kept their defenders high. It's also that they kept them fairly narrow, which could sometimes, you know, when that doesn't go well, that usually means that you are allowing defenses to come set and stay within their shape and you're not stretching them or trying to pull players out of position on the wings. But Louisville kind of played with no fear in that regard and kept Carson Pickett fairly central, which defensively works to nullify any possible out-of-the-back progression that Chicago could offer. But then it also allowed for attacking interchange in really high-value areas of the attacking mm-hmm. third, where she and Fisher, who was pulled really, really centrally, they created, you know, the two of them created this nice little triangle with Marissa DeGrande, who also looked very, very good and is filling in for Jalen Howell. You know, they just sort of pounded dangerous areas of Chicago's attacking third over and over again. And it just kind of has a lot to do with the fact that why be scared of the Red Stars fullbacks, you know? Why be scared of any possible, leaving of your defensive, your deeper defenders on an island behind you? And it didn't happen. Not really. Not until the end of the game. And again, that's game state influenced. So I thought it was really sharp. I mean, if I have any concerns, it's just that, like, why are Raylan Turner and Uchenna Kanu riding the bench?
Yeah, before we get to that question, they had the first 12 shots of the game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was so dominant, such one-way traffic. Taylor Flint, who is having a season that I think is borderline Emma Hayes, take a look at this, consider this player. No, because she's built well to be in that functional Emma Hayes midfield. Taylor Flint had just another one of those really high-quality performances we've come to expect of her. 71 touches, 5 tackles, 6 interceptions, 4 blocks. She continues to not be a high pass completion. You know, that's always been a challenge for her, but she plays risky passes. She is doing a lot of damage for this Louisville team and is presenting huge problems for every team trying to play through the middle against Louisville. And had another one of those games. Savannah DeMello is sort of like lurching out of her slow start. Mm-hmm. She had 5 shots.
Yeah.
She's starting to look more and more dangerous.
She's doing what she's doing, you know, being one of the best players who kind of live in that I'm half a 10, I'm half of a false 9 space where, like, you can split your strikers and let me just, like, run up the gut and take the shot myself off the dribble, or you can pull central and I will find the triangles to, you know, cut back lines open with her passing. You know, she's a special player. And also, she's one of the best at drawing fouls.
Yeah, absolutely. Flint, Pickett, DeMello. Those were the 3 top players for Louisville in touches.
Yeah.
If that is your baseline, you're going to win a lot of games because that is the right players with the ball constantly cycling through them.
And we talked about Seattle a couple of weeks ago and how their progression strategies of basically like having Sofía Puerta move the ball up the field and then ping a cross in, it was one-dimensional enough that defenses have learned to neutralize it. But Carson Pickett is not Sofía Puerta. Carson Pickett is the best passing fullback and also a naturally left-footed left back in the league. And she did not have a strong first couple of games this year, but she is just, she's just pounding that left side, even when she's pulling in. Her diagonal service is just, it's elite. And you look at like the maps of passes within the final third and passes into the box for Louisville, and it's really left-sided heavy, and that's not surprising.
Your main concern with Louisville that is forming is the inefficiency of the players they are deciding to start up top. So let's talk a little about that.
If you had more points on the board, if you weren't drawing as many games, and then you had a result like you had last night, you maybe say, okay, embarrassment of riches, you know, best kind of problem for a head coach to have, and we're just going to keep on trucking, playing really, really well. But you've drawn a lot of games, and if you were going to make it into the playoffs, you need to turn those draws into wins going forward. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the fine margins really do matter here. And by ASA's non-penalty XG plus XA per 96 model, league average for a winger or a striker, so for a forward, is about 0.35. Turner's sitting on a 0.6 figure. Kano's at 0.44. Kayla Fisher's at 0.22. And Alexa Barr's at 0.37. So basically, you are choosing to bench two elite players in favor of a league average one and someone who's really not pulling her weight offensively.
Yeah.
If you want to score more goals, you need to take every possible advantage available to you. So why, and especially because like Turner's been benched for 6 weeks now. I don't know what's going on there. Clearly, Giannis does not trust her as a starter anymore. And I'm not sure why. And Kanu, the last 3 weeks has made the bench in favor of Kayla Fisher. And somehow that makes even less sense to me.
Yeah, I wonder if on some level it's not managing your rookie and managing your 21-year-old.
Well, if that's the case, then Emmy Sears should have stayed on the bench, but she's not.
Yeah, but
she got promoted.
Sears is 23. There is a difference there. That said, I am generally with you. I think it was put into stark relief yesterday, the difference between Fisher and Turner.
Mm-hmm.
Turner, in 25 minutes, had three shots and created 0.3 XG. Fisher, in 65 minutes, had two shots, none of them on target, and created 0.1 XG. I mean, there was a solid XAG chance that Fisher created, but it was just not, you know, if Turner is coming on and delivering and generating more for you as a forward in 25 minutes than you're getting out of your starter, I feel like that's really clear messaging. Barr, on the other hand, six shots, 0.7 XG. That was a solid game. I think there is more an argument that Fisher is the real head scratcher and that reasonable minds can disagree about the effectiveness of Barr.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, Turner tends to play through the middle and Kanu plays on the left. So
yeah,
it's a like if you're going to bring Turner in, Barr is probably going to have to go. But Giannis really likes Alexa Barr. She's basically started every single game this year and she's fine. It's just that, you know, would she be more fine if she and Turner flipped their roles and it was Barr coming off the bench in the 70th minute? I don't know. I kind of feel like that might be true. And then, yeah, Kanu versus Fisher, I don't think it's a question.
Yeah, it's the Kayla Fisher of it all that is more perplexing to me.
Yeah.
That said, do you think, I'll ask sort of the same question, given the points on the board, they're on 12 points.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, if you were to sort of think about it in a power ranking kind of way, think they are where they belong in the table? Do you think they are better? Do you think they are worse?
I think that they might be a shade better than where they're at right now. I mean, forget, they also have a game in hand, so raw points is not necessarily reflective on a, you're not getting everybody on an apples to apples scale. But they're eighth. I mean, they're tied for eighth on points per game with San Diego. So, maybe they're a hair better than that, but I don't know if they're that much better than that. I mean, at a certain point, you know, their qualities in terms of XG per shot and XG per shot allowed, which they are quite good at. Again, they take very few shots. They don't allow very many shots, but the ones they do shoot and the ones they do allow are quite beneficial to them. But at a certain point, like, you are going to need to find some volume of quality, because, you know, the season's almost halfway done. Mm-hmm. And those draws have really cost you. So, and on volume, they are non-penalty XG differential per game by ASA's model. Yeah, they're sixth. Like, that's good. That's a playoff spot. That feels basically right. I might maybe drop them back a tick to seventh. But that's sort of where they're living. And to ensure, because we all know that the parity of the league will rear its ugly head, you know, the further we go down the line here, they just have to do everything to make sure that they're in that 6-7-8 window and they get into the dance in November. So I just have some questions about the way Bev Yanez is deploying her attacking force here.
To your point about the parity of the league, or at least maybe to complicate it a little bit, I actually look at Louisville's schedule and I say they've performed quite admirably, all things considered, as we now see what the quality of the teams are. They played the Pride twice.
Mm-hmm.
They played, they drew on opening day at home, and they only lost by a single goal and 0.3 XG away in Orlando, which is starting to look like a pretty decent result against the Pride.
Yeah.
They have already played Gotham away. They've already played the Thorns away. They've already played the Current away. Now, that was lucky that they got out of that 3-3 madhouse with a draw. But they've played a lot of really tougher end of this table. I think that the results, and you're right, to sort of put them in the XG table at sixth, I think that that's right on, or maybe even a little bit understating some of what they've been doing. Now, whether that results in them actually finishing even in a playoff spot, this looks like a team that could be very tragically set up to miss the playoffs despite being a good team. Maybe a little bit like Orlando last year.
And they've got room to make up points in the coming weeks. They've got the Dash at home next week. They'll have Angel City away a couple weeks after that, which, you know, it's kind of a gimme now. They got Bay FC at home, Chicago at home in late August. So there's a run in here, and also, you know, Seattle, which that sadly is not going to be a tough opponent either. So yeah, there is a softer upcoming window here schedule wise where they might be able to make up some ground.
Yeah, you like them, you know, over those next sort of in that June fixture block. June is a, you know, over those next five: Dash, Gotham, Angel City, Rain, Bay. You'd really hope they'd pick up 9 or 10 points out of those fixtures at least. And I feel like that'll be just a real crucial period to sort of figure out whether this Louisville team can establish itself as a team that's going to challenge for a home playoff spot, or whether this is a team that is going to rue their opportunities missed this season and look back and say, we just sort of kind of didn't put it together. But they're in this limbo place that's really interesting right now.
Absolutely. That's a good way of saying it. And again, if you want to talk about volume and referencing how maybe is this the moment where Houston turns a corner, or it's just a blip on the radar, like Louisville against Chicago, 38 touches in the box, 21 shots. It's high volume in two pretty key categories if you're going to produce on the attacking end. So if that is something that they can continue to do week to week, then, you know, the good chances are going to come to them.
So we had two huge results break the way of teams that have not seen that happen.
Oh yeah, and again, like, we don't even get to really have these, like, can they make the playoffs conversation if these wins don't occur.
I think both of us would obviously select Louisville as the team likelier to make the playoffs of the two teams sitting on 12 points there, who have gotten to their 12 points in completely different ways. Houston a little bit outperforming their results, but maybe benefiting now that now that what they are putting together starts looking a little more real. And Louisville maybe ruining what has come before and now need to make what they've done in game consistently reflect that in the table itself.
Yeah.
It's stunning to me that Louisville, you know, only two wins.
Yeah. And again, talking about like sort of depth and how you manage the next 15 games, like Marissa DeGrande legitimately had a great game. And that's why you signed her, because if, you know, a Taylor Flint or a Jalen Howell get hurt, you plug her in and it's relatively seamless. And Houston doesn't have really that kind of option unless they go out and get somebody in the summertime.
Yeah. Do you, anything else you want to cover? Thanks
so much for listening to Expected Own Goals. Be sure to rate us, review us, subscribe to us, rate us 5 stars if you're going to rate us at all. Please follow us on social media at XOwnGoals. That's the letter X Own Goals. And if you think that we've made an own goal, please email us at expectedowngoals@gmail.com. That's the letter expectedowngoals@gmail.com. We will speak to you guys on Thursday.
Bye-bye.